thank you very much, and thank you all for coming. What I'm going to do is talk for a little bit about this question of searching for democracy, and then really what I would most like to have a dialogue, and even though this room isn't set up perfectly for dialogue, I will somehow make it happen. I was interested that in that generous introduction, you said perhaps I'm best known for the Lead Underground. I never think of myself that way, but it's, you know, and I think if you ask my granddaughters, they would say, I don't even know what you're talking about. It was very funny, the night of the ABC debate, remember Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama were debating? I had my graduate students over for, my doctoral students over for dinner, and somebody turned on the TV at the end of dinner, and there was the end of the debate, and Stephanopoulos asked Obama about his relationship with me, and I had 15 students in the room, and five of them fell on the floor. They had never heard of this relationship that I'm best known for. It just depends on where you look, I suppose. Anyway, I'm almost 65 years old, so in a long life, I resist being labeled as any one thing. I'm still a work in progress, as you know, and maybe that's something to talk about. Well, let me begin, though. I don't know where you were on November 4th, 2008, but I'll bet you were paying attention. Is that correct? You were paying attention. Yes, I was in Grand Park in Chicago. Were any of you in Grand Park in Chicago? You're from Chicago. Max, were you? No. Well, don't worry about it. You can lie and say you were because there were millions of people there and nobody will know the difference. But I was in Grand Park, and I couldn't pry myself away. I spent most of the night there. It was an ecstatic experience. I went with a young man who was living with us at the time, with whom I'm writing a graphic novel, a law professor from Amsterdam, a professor from Zimbabwe, and we were all in the park together, just couldn't get enough of it, drinking it in. The sense of relief in that park that night was palpable. Didn't you feel a sense of relief, some of you? I mean, my God. We didn't have to put up with more years beyond the 8 years that we'd already endured. That was palpable, but there was also a real sense of possibility. And for me, I mean, there were three things that stood out for me, and I actually sobbed openly three or four times that night. But one was that here was the election of the first African-American president, and something that was unthinkable 2 years ago, was suddenly a done deal. The sense that this was a really significant blow against the legacy of white supremacy still hasn't left me. I'm still kind of tingling about that. It's not a fatal blow. It's not the final blow. And that would be a mistake. But it is a blow. And it's worth noting that something in the long, long, sad, tragic legacy of this country, something was breached in that moment. And that was significant. I also think it was hugely significant that there was a generational shift. That is, that we turned the page on all those old 60-year-olds, get them off the stage. That's how I feel. Well, I am one, but, you know, I'll stay for a minute. The idea that it's time for a new kind of vision, a new way of looking at things. And it was interesting that McCain, of all the kind of miscalculations in his campaign, the idea that he was going to run on the 60s and wave the bloody shirt, rethink the Vietnam War. He was somehow a hero, and then there were these traitors, you know. And I mean, what odd, you know, narrative that was. And for people your age, who wanted to get into that? And for people my age, you really want to refight the Vietnam War? Because we could, and we probably should. In a sense, that generational turning of the page is a problem because we've never adequately had a truth and reconciliation process in this country about what could be learned from Vietnam. And because we haven't learned the lessons of Vietnam, we find ourselves trudging right into the same pits and swamps and holes and caves, you know, and that's a problem. But all in all, let's shift, let's turn the generational page, yes. But more significant than that, for me, was the fact that we did elect a community organizer to the presidency. And I think that that's something we should take a moment to really understand and really embrace. Here's a man, you can't think of another president in history, because there isn't one, who would be comfortable knocking on the door of a public housing project and going in and having a cup of coffee with a family there and speaking about their problems for 40 minutes. That notion, the very idea that speaking to strangers is a good thing, is, I think, really an important, critical aspect of democracy. The idea that you only speak to people who agree with you, that you have to do a political litmus test before you'll talk, that somebody isn't a citizen or part of the real America unless they agree with you, that's nuts. And that's an absolute recipe for catastrophe in a democracy. So the idea that Obama, whatever else he knows, somewhere in his makeup is this idea that there's a value in talking to strangers, there's a value in listening to people and getting their read on things, and then understanding their particular hurt and hope, and from that sense of their own hurt and hope, to be able to do something. That's huge. And one real indication that he does understand this, I don't know if you remember, my favorite moment in the campaign was the moment when Obama was asked by a reporter in one of the primary debates, who would Martin Luther King support? Do you remember him being asked that? And Obama, without missing a beat, responded, King wouldn't support any of us. King would be in the streets building a movement for justice. That's a community organizer's answer. That's the answer of somebody who understands that while there is no doubt that power exists at the top, there's also no doubt that power comes from below and exists below. And that's where we live. And that's what we have to grasp, I think, fundamentally, if we're going to understand our responsibility as citizens. Now, some of you are probably political junkies. True? Are any of you political junkies? Yeah, some of you, my sympathies. Okay, come on, admit it. During the election, weren't you watching the polls like a neurotic? I mean, weren't you like crazy? Yes, of course you were. And I wasn't. I actually ignored the whole thing. Because I couldn't, if I got sucked into it, I would have spent a lot of time being defensive and worried, and so I didn't, it went by. I have three grown sons, they're all political junkies, so they would feed me the latest. Sometimes they would text me and say, you know, a couple weeks before the election, there's a 98% chance that Obama's gonna win. There were these websites that said shit like that, kind of bizarre. Anyway, so you political junkies. And then after the election, didn't you suffer a kind of a postpartum depression? Like, oh God, you know, now we have the baby, what the hell are we doing? I know a lot of people are in it. And that's why I feel, even to this day, thank God for Minnesota, it's still in play. So you know, we still have polls you can read every morning if you're really crazy. And I know some of you are. So there's Illinois. There's a lot to think about and look at. But really, the sense of postpartum depression, and then all during the transition when Obama was just made a mess out of our neighborhood, Max. And some friends here from the neighborhood. And, you know, so we live two doors from each other. And Obama lives, what, two blocks away. And God, they created a green zone there. I had to get checked. My ID had to be checked to go home. It's completely crazy. But it was, you know, small sacrifice. But so everybody's watching the transition, and they're talking like this. They're saying, "What does it mean, Rahm Emanuel? What's that going to mean for my future? And do you think Obama's going to help us? What does this mean, Summers in Treasury or Summers as the economic advisor?" What does that mean? And again, I think that's a bad case of postpartum depression, because you're looking with all due respect in the wrong direction. You're looking at the palace. It's like sifting the garbage outside the king's mansion. Instead of asking yourself, what the hell am I doing? What am I doing? So it's one thing to say, what's Obama going to do for me? It's quite another thing to say, what am I doing? And I've urged young people for months now that anytime you have the impulse to put a press on the Obama administration, which I'm not against, but when you have that impulse, you have to start by asking yourself, what press have I put on myself? What have I demanded of myself? I'm demanding something of Obama, but what am I demanding of myself? And why do I say that? I say that because all history will tell you that as smart as Obama is, and he is the smartest guy in any room he walks into, as compassionate and as decent as he might be, and incidentally, as moderate as he is. You know, he has said from the beginning, I am a moderate, and the right wing won't have any of it. He's a communist, he's a socialist, he's something. No, I'm a moderate, he says. And the left won't have it either. Nice, just sneak it in, and then they'll do what we want to do. No, he won't. He is a moderate, and he's a smart guy and a decent guy, and he's also a moderate. But here's what history tells us. Lyndon Johnson, the most effective politician of his generation, passed the most far-reaching civil rights legislation in history. No one could have done it but Johnson. He was not a member of the Black Freedom Movement. Never part of it, never participated in it. Franklin Roosevelt wasn't part of the labor movement. And Abraham Lincoln never belonged to an abolitionist party. And that's significant, because these three presidents who go down as history as these great men, well, Johnson not so much, and there's a cautionary tale there too, because Johnson burned up his accomplishments in the furnaces of war. That's always a possibility for American leaders, always. And that's something we should worry about and mobilize to not allow. And in that regard, parenthetically, when people kind of are acting as if Obama can save us, or will Obama save us, the answer to that is no. But the real truth is, we can save Obama. That is, we as a mobilized force for peace and justice could save the Obama administration. He will not save us. So the question is, what's the press you're putting on yourself? What are you demanding of yourself? And then, yes, we can also make demands on the president and on that administration, but only insofar as we're willing to mobilize, organize, and the kind of movement we need to mobilize and organize is a movement of organizers. One of the exciting things about this election was it was the most participatory election I've ever seen, perhaps ever in history. More people got out and knocked on more doors and spoke to more strangers. My brother, who's a Democratic Party activist, and he spent a lot of time in Wisconsin and Indiana. You know, my brother, he called me as running up towards the election. He'd spent a lot of time in Indiana. And he said, Obama's going to take Indiana. And I said, gee, the polls don't say that. And he said, no, I'm here. I can tell you. Everyone I talk to is for Obama. I said, where are you now? And he said, I'm at Starbucks. I said, get the hell out of Starbucks. Of course everybody's for Obama at Starbucks. Go to Dunkin' Donut. Talk to somebody. Anyway, it's what happens. But the point really is that this was a participatory event. Many of you participated in it. And the spirit of it is very, very important and worth noting. The spirit of yes, we can. The politics of 9/11, the politics of fear and war and violence and the stripping of our civil rights, all of that, the page is turned. Now it's yes, we can. But it's up to us to say yes, we can what? Yes, we can fill in the blank. And here is where the responsibility on you and on me becomes most serious. And I want to argue that this is a moment of movement making or movement building. And that movement making and movement building requires certain things of us. And I want to just briefly outline it, and then I want to really have a dialogue of questions and answers. But this is the way I've been thinking about it quite a lot. The crisis that we're facing is a crisis of rising expectations, yes we can, on the one hand, and on the other hand, real limitations, not imagined limitations, real limitations. So yes we can, but we can't actually, you know, when we say yes we can't actually have the American dream, that is an endless series of single family homes just blanketing the world. No, we can't do that. Yes, we can, but no, we can't actually have everybody driving a car. And actually, we ought to be, Obama, I think, very wisely talked last weekend over the weekend, about reducing the nuclear stockpile. I wish he were also talking about reducing the automotive stockpile. You know, I mean, isn't it time that we have sensible public transportation? Isn't it time that we rethink how we get around? I mean, the right on, I got a fist pump back there. Is that a terrorist fist pump? I thought it was. I couldn't tell. I couldn't tell what it was. But Yes, we can, but real limitations. Environmental catastrophe, not someday, not abstractly, but right here, right now. An economic crisis that's real and abiding. And underneath that economic crisis, the question of what will America's role be in the world. So yes, we can, real limitations. And we ought to be thinking hard about how to build a movement within that gap, within the gap of rising expectations for a better world, but serious limitations about whether the world as we know it can possibly go on indefinitely into the future. And I would argue, no, it can't. But so, three things that I think are required of you and are required of me, and are required if we're going to make anything out of this particularly precious, fragile, and fascinating moment that we're living in. First thing is, you cannot be a citizen. You can't be a good citizen. And you can't be an activist unless you're willing to open your eyes. You have to open your eyes to the world as it is. And that means seeing things that both make you ecstatic and interested and fascinated, and also that horrify you. You can't sit with your eyes closed and be an active citizen. It's just not possible. So opening your eyes is step one, and I'm going to go back to it. Step two is doing something about it, acting on whatever the known demands. And step three is rethinking, re-criticizing yourself, rethinking whether everything you did made all that much sense. So there's a poem by Mary Oliver, and in the middle of it, there's a little piece called Instructions for Living a Life. And that's really all I'm saying. What Mary Oliver says it is, pay attention, be astonished, do something. I kind of like that. Pay attention, be astonished, do something. Though I want to say pay attention. You can't be an activist, you can't be a clear thinker, you can't be a citizen, you can't be a moral person unless you're willing to open your eyes. So let's take a couple of historical examples. Y'all are against slavery, right? No?
Yes.
I want something, an amen. You're against slavery. Thanks. Now, Mike, wake up. Pay attention, for Christ's sake. Okay, so we're against slavery, and good for us. And for those of us who are white in the room, and if it was 1840, do you imagine you'd have been against slavery?
Yeah.
Good. I hope so. I think maybe we could have been, you know, all riding with, you know, Harriet Tubman or John Brown or somebody. I like to think so. So let's flatter ourselves. Absolutely, in 1840, we would have been hardcore abolitionists. But if we were hardcore abolitionists, let's just remember this. We'd have been against the law. We'd have been against our parents. We would have been against tradition, common sense, the Bible, our preacher, our brothers and sisters, and almost everybody we knew. So what the hell? We're all abolitionists now. And we like to think we'd have been abolitionists then. Would we have been? We're not sure. But at least it was a question, it's important to note, it was in contention then. Abolitionism was known then. It wasn't like, you know, Thomas Jefferson knew that there was abolitionism. It's not like he didn't choose, he chose. And it's also interesting to note, and important to note, that Thomas Jefferson could both write the Declaration of Independence and rape Sally Hemings, and possibly on the same day. It's true. So, I mean, he's great, and yet not so great. Right? True. So it's important to remember that about history, that we like to smooth things over. And in our soundbite culture, we want good guys and bad guys. But okay, let's imagine 1840. So let me take another historical example. You all are for a woman's right to vote, right?
Yes.
Male voices, please.
Yeah.
I gotta keep waking you up here. Okay, sure. We're all for a woman's right to vote. 100 years ago,
Yes.
You know, the argument against women's voting 100 years ago was they'll just vote like their husbands and fathers. That was the major argument against. Same argument that's made today about why kids shouldn't vote. I'm a huge advocate. I don't want to get into it because it's too controversial, but kids should vote, of course. They'll just vote like their parents. So what? Aren't they citizens? Apparently not. Of course, felons should vote. I don't want to get into all that. Okay. But the point is, if you were for a woman's right to vote, it'd have been against the law, against tradition, against the Bible, and on and on. We're all against the internment of the Japanese today. We're all against dropping nuclear weapons on Japan today. We're all for Nelson Mandela today. But that's too easy. So the reason I raise those historic examples is, what are we missing that we take for granted, that we just take as part of the air we breathe? What are we missing? I'll just give you two examples. One, 30 years from now, when your granddaughter says to you, "Were you in Grand Park, Chicago, 2008, November 4th? You can say yes, because nobody will know. You can even say you were at the inauguration. But the other thing she might ask you is she might say, "Were you around when the first African-American president was elected? And if things work out well, you can say, yes, I was, with a certain amount of pride. And I even knocked on doors, and I did this and did that." And then she might say, "Is it true that it cost him $750 million to be elected? And you call that democracy?" And you'll say, "Really? I don't remember that part." Yeah, she'll say, "Yeah, you guys thought that was democracy. You guys were out of your mind." And you might say feebly, "He raised it on the internet." And she'll say, "Big fucking deal." I'm just saying, I'm not saying that will happen, I'm just saying that it's the kind of thing that you could imagine. Or your granddaughter will say, "So you went to, you know, the Claremont College and colleges and whatnot, and when you went to college, there were 2.3 or 4 million of your fellow citizens in prison." And you'll say, "Yeah, I think that's true. We were against that stuff. And there was one just miles from your campus. Do you know that?" Or with my students, I often tell them, you know, 1 mile from our campus in Chicago, there are 18,000 black men caged 1 mile from our campus. And it's a gulag, and nobody sees it, and it's invisible. And if I said to you, and okay, I'm saying that to you, 18,000 black men in a cage. And you know it, but hey, you know, it kind of makes sense, and it's kind of the world we live in, isn't it? What if I said 18,000 Jewish women are locked up over there? You'd say, "No, possibly, no way, what they do." Well, it's just the way, what we get acclimated to, what we assume, what we take for granted, right? The death penalty, and so on and so on. So all I'm saying is the world we're living in is not finished any more than the world of 1840 was finished. And we are living in history, and we are works in progress. And what we do or don't do, what we notice or don't notice, has a lot to do with what the outcome of not only this administration, but our lives are going to amount to. Now, it's very easy to close your eyes or to make the assumption that being conventional is the same as being moral or being ethical. Like if I said to you, Were you an ethical person today? Yeah, I think so. What's the proof? I didn't kill anybody. Well, good for you. That's great. Another day without killing anybody, I'm pleased. But really, what did you do affirmatively to name the problems in the world and to do something about them? And this takes me to another example, more contemporary. Have some of you seen the film Central Station? It's a film from Brazil. Go and get it on Netflix immediately. Write it down. No, I'm just kidding. I'm a professor, so I sometimes say, "Write it down," but ignore me. When I say that, just ignore me. Just like you ignore your professors. Yeah, write it down. Central Station. It's a story that takes place in Brazil. It was up for an Academy Award a decade ago. And it's a retired teacher who writes letters for illiterates in the Central Station of Rio de Janeiro. And Rio is like Southern California, very complicated, hard to get around. And one day a guy who she knows from the Central Station comes to her and says, "Dora, I'd like you to do a job for me. I want you to go to this address on the far side of Rio, pick up a 9-year-old boy, deliver him to this address. It'll take you most of the day, and I'll meet you there and give you $1,000. The boy is going to be adopted by a rich American couple." So Dora does the job, gets the $1,000, and on her way home, she stops and buys a television. She's sitting in her humble apartment watching the TV when a neighbor comes over and asks about the TV, and Dora tells her the story. And the neighbor says to her, "Dora, are you insane? Don't you pay any attention to the world? Don't you read the papers?" Dora says, "What do you mean?" She says, "That boy wasn't adopted. Nobody, no American couple adopts a 9-year-old. He was sold into the market for organs. He's probably already been killed, and his organs harvested for this lucrative international organ donor market." Now that's all in the first 20 minutes. So what does Dora do? Dora spends the rest of the film trying to retrace her steps to find the boy to save his life. And we who have the money and live in the West and consume a movie like that, we expect nothing less. We expect her to do exactly that. But what sometimes happens when you see a film like that is you realize that you also are Dora. You're also implicated. You also have, you know, in some sense, a guilty conscience. You also, if you're paying attention, if your neighbor comes to you and says, "Aren't you watching?" then you notice, and then you say, "Oh my God." You know, and then you have to retrace your steps and ask yourself, "How do I save the boy? How do I do the right thing?" I think about my mother, my beloved mother, who died maybe a decade ago. And maybe 15 years ago, I was taking care of her, and she had broken her ankle. And she asked me, quite innocently, she knows better, but occasionally she would ask me something that she shouldn't ask me. And she asked me, "What is this thing I've heard of called global warming?" And I gave her a very mild, believe me, very watered down, didn't want to scare the shit out of the old lady, because I was like, calm. And she looked at me very cold, very, you know, chill, and she said to me, "Well, I'm sorry I asked." Well, exactly. Because you asked, now you heard, and because you heard, now you feel you have to do something, and you have to change your life, and you don't want to change your life. That's the beauty of privilege. The beauty of privilege is that it anesthetizes you to the world. And so the final example, the wonderful novel by José Saramago, the Nobel laureate from Portugal. The novel is called Blindness. Write it down. Blindness is the story. It begins in a modern city, unnamed, and a man is in a traffic jam, and in the first paragraph he suddenly goes blind, and all hell breaks loose around him. Somebody helps him from his car and then steals his car. He makes his way home with the assistance of someone in the crowd, and his wife takes him to a clinic, and everyone in the clinic has mysteriously gone blind. And the doctors and the authorities don't know what to do with them, so they quarantine them behind a barricade, in an abandoned hospital. And the guards are guarding them, and it's a nasty, awful situation. It gets worse and worse as more and more people go blind, and eventually the guards go blind. And eventually, layer after layer, the entire world goes blind. And in their blindness, people form themselves into gangs, and they prey on one another, and they fight over shelter, they fight over food, they hoard food, they steal from one another. Gangs of men rape gangs of women. And as it sinks into a deeper and deeper and darker dystopia, you don't know how it can get any worse. And at the moment when they're at the bottom rung of the ladder, the first guy's sight comes back, and he blinks his eyes on again. And then the next person, and the next person, and suddenly everyone can again see, and they embrace one another, but awkwardly, because of what they've just done to one another. And somebody cries out, "Why did we go blind, and why can we now see?" And at that point the narrator says, "Perhaps we didn't go blind, perhaps we were blind, blind to people who could see, seeing people who were blind." And that is very much the message of Central Station. We are, all of us in the modern world, seeing people who are blind. Who doesn't know about the catastrophe of AIDS in Southern Africa? Who doesn't know? We all know. Who doesn't know that we were lied into Iraq, and that the lie that takes us into Pakistan is unfolding before us? Who doesn't know about the environmental catastrophe that lies just ahead? We know, and yet, we're blind. And so the charge to all of us is open our eyes, open your eyes, pay attention. And when you pay attention, you then have to do something. And the doing something is often uncomfortable. And the problem, of course, with doing something is there's no perfect thing to do. Sometimes my students, when I get passionate in this direction, will say to me, "I can't do everything." And my response is, "Can you do anything? Can you do anything? Because anything is all you have to do. You don't have to do everything. Nobody wants you to die or stop eating or anything like that. But you have to do something." I'm reminded very quickly of a little story. You know that Illinois led the country in doing away with the death penalty in the recent round of abolitionist activity. And it was quite a shock because our right-wing, mildly corrupt, now imprisoned Governor George Ryan put an end to the death penalty in Illinois one day before he was to leave office. And I watched over 8 years George Ryan become an abolitionist. And it was an astonishing journey. And it gave me a lot of hope that not only can good people like you do things, but people you wouldn't even expect. If you organize properly and you build a movement, even George Ryan can do the right thing. So I'll tell you real quickly. I don't remember the date, but maybe you remember, Max, like maybe, must be 18 years ago or something when Illinois reinstated the death penalty, maybe 20 years ago. And in its wisdom, it decided it was going to electrocute a man named John Wayne Gacy, who was a serial killer and a very unpleasant, unattractive person. And as the execution date came closer, and I was not involved in any anti-death penalty movement myself at all, really my instincts are in that direction, but I wasn't really involved. But as the date became closer and closer, the media became more and more frantic about how exciting it was to kill this guy. And the AM radio was just positively frothing at how great it was. They were playing songs for him and dedicating things to his death. And it became so sickening to me personally that I had a talk with my partner. We had three little kids at the time. We didn't call you to babysit. Instead, we chose straws, and I got to go down to Statesville to stand in opposition to this execution. Not because I had anything nice to say about John Wayne Gacy, but because I had nothing nice to say about the state of Illinois killing John Wayne Gacy. So anyway, I went down there all by myself. I didn't know anybody. And I made a little sign that I put under my shirt. It said, "Thou shalt not kill." And I felt really silly and marginal. And I often feel marginal, but that was a particularly marginalized night. Anyway, I went down there, and as I got closer, there was what amounted to a rock party going on the street leading to the prison. There were probably 2,000 young people having with boom boxes and beer, dancing on the top of cars and going crazy, waiting for the lights to be dimmed at midnight, which would indicate that Gacy was dying. And I was so horrified, and yet I felt I had to make my way to the front of the prison, hiding my sign. I didn't want to get killed on the way. And I got to the front of the prison, and there was a little circle of six nuns, each of them probably over 80, carrying a candle, and a young attorney named Larry Marshall, who was a colleague of my partner's at Northwestern Law School, and his fiancée. And so the 10 or 11 of us stood there holding candles and singing hymns. Boy, did we feel silly, and the police protected us, thank you, Illinois State Police and everything. And then he was executed, and then we left. And I felt pretty empty about the whole experience, but I wasn't sorry I'd gone. I didn't do anything, but I wasn't sorry anyway. A year later, Larry Marshall, this man that stood next to him, who was a very good friend, won the first wrongful conviction case in Illinois. And a year later, he won the second one. And then it accelerated, and it turned out that 13 of the 25 people on Illinois' death row were wrongfully convicted, not on some technicality. DNA proved that they were wrong. And if DNA proved those guys, what about the ones who didn't have DNA? So the Tribune did a big series, and it was Pulitzer Prize winning. And then journalism students got involved and started organizing. And then the anti-death penalty movement grew and grew and grew. And George Ryan began making appearances saying, "I'm just a pharmacist from Kankakee. I can't participate in the machinery of death." And Larry Marshall met with him once a week and worked on it. And meanwhile, there was a mass movement. So the people of Illinois might be perfectly happy to execute people, but not arbitrarily. And so we saw in Illinois, in 6 years, in 4 years, a movement built that changed the state of justice in Illinois. What an amazing thing. What an exciting victory. Small on the scale of what we have to do, but huge in terms of pointing out the value of one voice and then another voice and then one person, and then another person. So you have to act. How you act, I don't know. You have to act. You have to stand up and be heard in the public square. And what that means is that it's not enough to think I'm a good person sitting happily on my couch in my dorm room or smoking a joint and talking to my friends. It's not good enough. It might be good, but it's not good enough. You have to be good in the world. You have to say where you stand in the world. And once you say where you stand on questions of justice and peace in the world, you have the world push back against you. And then you begin to learn. And then you push back, and then you get pushed back. And that's how we learn. But it's very important to me in this notion of acting that whatever else you do, you keep a pedagogical standard in mind, and that is, did I convince anybody? And did I learn anything? If you convince somebody and you learn something, then it was probably a good action. You can't always know that in advance. But if you didn't persuade anybody, if it was just performative for you, look at me, I'm so cool. Because I really stand on the right side of everything. That's not good enough. You have to persuade people. And that means, among other things, learning how to talk and how to change the frame, which is something I want to talk about today. So, you have to act. And then finally, you have to doubt. If all you do is act, you become an adventurous and you become narcissistic. You become certain of yourself. You become dogmatic. You know what I mean when I say dogmatic? Like, you've seen Monty Python, The Life of Brian, right? Have you?
Mm-hmm.
Write this down. See The Life of Brian. You guys are very hip. You ought to have seen The Life of Brian. It's a Monty Python thing. Anyway, it's about a reluctant messiah. And at one point, for the old people here, I think, he's standing on a rampart, and he's saying to the mob below, I am not the Messiah. And they all look at him and say, you're not the Messiah. And he says, no. You have minds of your own. And they say, we have minds of our own. At one point, a guy in the crowd says, funny, I don't feel like I have a mind of my own. And they all say, shut up, you have a mind of your own. You know, but that's dogma. That's dogma. When it's full up. When it's full up, you can't hear anybody else. You get imprisoned. And you get trapped in a kind of a prison of one bright idea, and you can't think through it. So I remember when we were first in Chicago, I went with one of my partners, law partners, to look at a daycare at a little school for her children, and it was a Montessori school. And we looked around the school, and as we went through the school, the director kept saying, "Maria Montessori says." Maria Montessori was the founder of the Montessori movement. Maria Montessori says the children are doing such and such. Maria Montessori says, and I felt myself being hypnotized, you know. And so I said to my friend, don't drink the Kool-Aid when we break, because you don't know what's going on here. And at the break, the parents were talking, and we were talking about Carl Rogers and Carl Jung. And apropos of that conversation, I said, you know, Jung once said, I'm glad I'm Jung and not a Jungian, because I can still change my mind. To which the Montessori woman said, Maria Montessori says the same thing. But that problem of dogma, the problem of certainty, the problem of a single idea, this was really the problem of the Weather Underground. It was too sure. It was too sure of itself. It was too sure it had figured it out. And that's wrong. It's always wrong. There's always something more to know. So that third step is critical. You have to rethink. If you don't act, then you're cynical. And that's a different form of narcissism. If all you do is act, then you're adventurous and dogmatic. That's another form of narcissism. So that's the trick. How do you do all of that? So in this moment, rising expectations, real limitations, we have to rethink kind of all the kind of verities and insist on getting out of the traps let me say it this way, we have to get out of the trap of the dogma of common sense. The dogma of common sense. And that means reframing every discussion. So for example, I'll just give a couple quick examples. For example, during the campaign, I was never more irritated than every time I heard John McCain say, we've got to get I'm an educator, you know, I'm a teacher, and I teach teachers. And McCain would stand up and say, we've got to get the lazy, incompetent teachers out of the classroom. And all of us would kind of nod dully. What am I going to do? Stand up and say, the incompetents must stay. The lazy ones must get a raise. What am I going to say? I can't say that. Because, it's, you know, of course he won the argument by saying it the way he said it. If I got up first and got to the microphone ahead of him and said, every kid in an American public school deserves an intellectually curious, morally grounded, compassionate, decent, fully, you know, rested, well-paid teacher, we agree with that too. So who gets to name the debate? Who gets to frame the debate? And we see this constantly now as debates, as issues are in conflict. So we can see, I was talking earlier with some kids about seeing, for example, the metaphor around gay love changing before our eyes. Not that we're not still filled with contentious debate, but have you seen the film Milk? If you haven't seen it, you must go see it. And if you've seen it once, see it again. Because, and write it down. No, we can't write that. I love Robert De Niro saying to Sean Penn, you should play straight people more often. You do that pretty well, you know, because he was so good as Harvey Milk. Anyway, never mind, it was a joke. But one of the there's two things to note about the film. One is that it opens, as the credits are going by, groups of gay men are being rounded up in gay bars and herded into paddy wagons where they're either shamed or defiant. But they're breaking the law, and they're being rounded up as lawbreakers because being gay in America was against the law 40 years ago, everywhere. And until 10 years ago in some places. So being gay was against the law. That's important to remember. If you conducted, if you lived the gay lifestyle, you were a criminal. And you were crazy. Remember, it was 1974 that when the American Psychiatric Association decided it was no longer a pathology to be gay. And then, even though they're purely scientific, believe me, they never would do anything as gross as responding to politics. But the same year that they did that, they took another thing that they had on their list of psychosis was women who were beaten. It was called something like masochistic something disorder. Damn! You know, that was taken off too. But suddenly, in one day, millions of Americans were healthy who had been insane the day before. So, you know, these things change, right? So what you see in the film Milk is you see a metaphor in front of your eyes. And for me, 64 years old, I watched all this, I witnessed all this, I participated in all this, and it's kind of fascinating to see, even though we're still fighting, and I blame you guys for Proposition 8, incidentally, we had a great demonstration in Chicago, but California, get it together, come on. But you know, Proposition 8 happened, there was a great response in the country, it will be undone. Did you read the Iowa decision yesterday? Astonishing, wow, what a great decision. Like Brown v. Board of Education, it's not that it's going to lead to all good things, necessarily, but what it affirms in legal language is the full humanity of our GLBTQ brothers and sisters, and that's worth the price of admissions. And that's something Harvey Milk was fighting for. So what you see, the other reason I want you to see Milk is that Milk is the story of a real activist. It's not that happy talk story of that we get a Martin Luther King birthday prayer breakfast, just the arc is just upward and onward and everything turns out well. No, Harvey Milk rose up to fight and was knocked down. And then he rose up again and was knocked down again. Rose up again, was assassinated. And the film is Harvey Milk getting up again. And that's why we have to support it. That's why we have to fight Prop 8, because the full humanity of all is part of what we as people who are participating in history have to believe in and fight for. So, again, my students say I can't do everything, and my response is you don't have to do everything, do something. Or sometimes I say, all you have to do is be a mensch. You know the word mensch? It's Yiddish, and it means a good person. But I refer to it in the way that Rosa Luxemburg, the great socialist of the turn of the last century, used the word. She wrote in a letter from prison, she was in prison, for not supporting Germany in World War I. And she wrote, a friend had written to her asking, how do I be an activist? And Luxemburg wrote back and said, what you need to do is to commit to being a mensch. And then she said, I can't define it for you except to say, a mensch is somebody who loves her own life enough to take care of the children and the elders, to enjoy a good meal and the sunrise and the sunset, to have the company of friends, and relish the company of friends, on the one hand. But a mensch is also someone who's willing to put her shoulder on history's wheel when history requires it. And history does require it. So, be a mensch. Thanks very much.